WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
A 2-year sting operation run by U.S. Customs ended this week with the indictment of an international bank involved in laundering drug money for the international cocaine cartel based in Medellin, Colombia. Bank officials and drug traffickers were also indicted as a result of this money laundering sting. My guest, Elaine Shannon, has been covering international drug trafficking for the last 10 years, for Newsweek and now for Time magazine. Her new book, Desperados, is about the politics of drugs. She's investigated Latin American countries where, in some places, drug lords can buy off officials at every level of government. And Shannon has investigated the U.S. war on drugs. By the time Ronald Reagan took office, she says, an American president dared not acknowledge the extent of the Latin American drug trade or official complicity in it. To do so would risk insulting foreign leaders who were valued allies. Let's get to money laundering first and why it's so essential to international drug traffickers.
When you sell drugs on the street, you get a lot of $5 and $10 bills, and sometimes you get 20s and 100s. That's street-level sales. You can't carry that around. You can't go buy a house with it. It's just too bulky. When you're talking about people who are doing $10 million or $20 million in volume a month, that gets pretty bulky. They need trucks, and so they needed the money converted into small things that they can move around or wire transfers. What they need is cashier's checks so that they can put one in their shoe or put it in their pocket and fly it to Switzerland or France or Vancouver or wherever they want to buy property, or they need to wire transfer the money to pay their suppliers or to buy property in the Caribbean or whatever they want to do with it.
Why has it been so difficult to stop money laundering?
Well, because the traffickers themselves don't put their money in the bank in their own name so that it can be wire transferred to wherever they want it to go to. There's a whole new business that started in the late 70s of people who specialize in laundering money. So they get the money from the traffickers, and they put the money into various accounts in their names or their runners' names. And there are a lot of, there would be 100 accounts in the name of Esther Gonzalez and Maria Fernandez in Miami. You're never going to figure out who those are. And that's, it's a whole cottage industry, these money launderers.
Now that there has been a big sting that has busted a major bank that was doing a lot of money laundering, do you think that drug traffickers are going to be more vulnerable?
Oh, there are plenty more banks. So this happened to be a Middle Eastern bank, and they were pretty sloppy in the way they did it. They actually went to the undercover agents, not knowing who they were. The undercover agents were posing as money launderers. The bank officers noticed what they were doing and went to them and said, hey, we realize what you're doing, and we can help you do it better. Now, that's pretty heavy-handed. But there are plenty of banks all over the United States that are being used. There are certain rules that require banks to report deposits of cash over $10,000. So this has given rise to a practice called smurfing, in which a money launderer will go into the bank and buy a cashier's check for $9,000 because that doesn't have to be reported. The bill in Congress lowers the reporting level to $3,000, so that may cut a little bit of it out, but there are plenty of other ways to launder money, buying real estate directly, for instance.
So you don't think that this successful sting is going to have that much of an impact?
I think it will have an impact on the banks. This is the biggest bank that has ever been indicted. It is an international bank. It operates worldwide in something like 50 or 60 countries. Banks do not like to be publicized with this kind of reputation, and I think other banks and brokerages and other financial institutions that are being used are going to be a lot more vigilant.
Time magazine correspondent Elaine Shannon is my guest, and she's the author of the new book Desperados, Latin Drug Lords, U.S. Lawmen, and the War America Can't Win. Panama is the country that has become most famous for its money laundering operations. How did Panama become a center for money laundering?
Bank secrecy. They have laws which prevent anybody, and particularly the United States agencies, from getting behind the shells that are the bank accounts in Panama and finding out what's in those bank accounts. It's also a very convenient place for drug traffickers because people speak Spanish. So if you're a big drug trafficker, all you have to do is put your money on a Learjet in Miami and fly it to Panama and be assured of complete secrecy. There was one money launderer who would fly every few days in his jet, and he would get the VIP treatment at the airport from the officials there. They would meet him with an armored truck. Everybody knew who he was. He was very famous, and it was just fine by the Panamanian government.
Do you think that there's going to be any change in Panama's money laundering since the indictment of General Noriega?
The change is that the United States is probably going to get less information than it was before. Just before the indictment of Noriega, because of intense pressure from the DEA and the Customs Service, the Panamanian legislature had passed a law giving a little bit of access to certain bank records. And this would have helped the American government get behind all of those shells. But, of course, when the Noriega thing blew up and when he got indicted, the government is hardly willing to cooperate in that sort of enterprise, and so I think we're going to see very little of it. The customs agents who worked on the sting this week in Florida tell me that they were laundering a lot of money through Panama because this is where the traffickers wanted the money to go, but they can't get those records.
The officials can't get the records?
The U.S. officials, the undercover agents who were working on the sting in Florida, Operation Sea Chase, as in $100 bill chase, they laundered money. They know where it went. They know what accounts it went to in Panama because they sent it there as undercover agents, but they can't get the documents in Panama relating to that. Where did it go from there?
A major problem that you've covered for Time magazine and that you also write about in your new book, Desperados, is how certain government officials in Latin America and law enforcement officials have become complicit with the drug warlords. Is this something new?
No, it's not, but it's bigger than anybody imagined it would be 10 years ago. There's so much fabulous wealth throughout the Third World and in the United States that these officials could not possibly live in the style to which they become accustomed if they lived off their government salary of $100 or $200 a month.
So you're saying that the warlords pay them off?
Oh, yes.
The drug warlord?
Absolutely, all over the world.
The drug lords, that's what I mean.
Well, some of them are warlords. I mean, they have their own private armies, and they're more powerful than the government armies. They've got better arms. They've got better airplanes. They've got better trucks. They're very well-equipped people. Intimidation is a major factor, but in every country where drugs are produced or transshipped, these are very poor countries. Officials are paid very little. Often there is a system that officials buy their jobs for $1 million, and then they pay $100,000 or $200,000 a month to the central government for the privilege of being in that particular job, because usually the very expensive jobs are in major smuggling centers, and then they use their power in that city to extort the traffickers living in that area. The traffickers have to pay, $1,000 a kilo or something like that to operate there. And that's an informal system of paying the government, because the official salary means nothing.
So on the highest government levels, the drug lords can pay off and contribute to the salary of the government leaders. But you describe how this operates even on a small level, that police officials, law enforcement officials are frequently on the take.
Oh, yes. Well, the powerful people in a city, let's say, would be the head of the federal police, the head of the state police, not so much the mayor, maybe. I mean, you could pay the mayor, but the people that you really need to pay, if you are in any city in any of these trafficking centers, you have to pay the police officials and you have to pay the military commander for that particular zone. Now, this takes place in the Golden Triangle. It takes place in Mexico. It takes place in Colombia, Peru, wherever you're talking about. The system generally works the same way. Some places are worse than others. For instance, in Mexico, Mordida is a particularly ingrained form of corruption. I've just recently talked to agents who came back from Colombia who say it's not that bad in Colombia because they pay certain officials, they terrify others, but it's not all-encompassing a system as the Mordida system, or that means the bite or the bribe in Mexico.
Well, in Mexico, this makes it very difficult for American Drug Enforcement Agency officers to operate because they're working with law enforcement officials who are frequently on the take. And you describe how they're also afraid that their sources will be tortured or intimidated if they're discovered.
Yes, and they have been tortured, intimidated, chopped up, killed, had their fingers pulled off, been sawed up, ice picked to death. It's terrible what happens to informants down there.
Has the Drug Enforcement Agency and the State Department been at odds over how to deal with corrupt political leaders who are on the take?
Oh, yes, very much so in the past. The State Department's usual position is that we will deal with this in private. We will be tough in private, but we will not tell the American people about it or the press or the Congress.
For diplomatic reasons.
For diplomatic reasons. We don't want to embarrass these people. It would be counterproductive. All it will do is create a lot of, or worsen anti-Americanism and arouse nationalism. Now,
and it might badly affect our trade. Is that part of it?
Trade. A lot of these countries, particularly Mexico, have huge outstanding loans that they owe to U.S. banks and European banks, and the bankers do not want the economy of these countries undermined by travel advisories, tourist advisories, because they won't get paid back.
So how has this conflict between the Drug Enforcement Agency and other parts of the government, like the State Department, been played out?
There's tremendous tension in many embassies and many areas between people in law enforcement who are very linear people who see a corrupt official or trafficker and they want to do something about it. And with diplomats who say, well, let's talk about it, let's meet, let's have a communique, let's deal with it in some other way. Actually, the interesting thing is since the murder of Kiki Camarena, who is a DEA agent killed in Mexico in 1985 by traffickers and elements of the police, the State Department has gotten a lot tougher. Ironically, it's been the Justice Department under Ed Meese, which was the agency which was saying, go slow, let's cooperate, let's say nice things, and State Department was getting tougher and tougher.
Now that General Noriega of Panama has been indicted, do you think that this has sent a message from America to other corrupt government leaders in other countries? What do you think that counts for?
Oh, it counts for a little bit, but there's still a tremendous amount of corruption out there, and you don't see crackdowns in all of these countries. You see some activity. Congress has, since the murder of Camarena and since the indictment of Noriega, Congress has become much more vigilant about the issue of corruption and what the United States government knows about that corruption, and there have been a lot of hearings about whether or not the executive branch is covering up for various officials with whom the CIA and the Pentagon and the State Department have cozy relationships for other reasons. So a lot more is coming out about corrupt officials all over the world. The problem with that is that a lot of these officials don't really think about the big picture and they don't think they're going to get caught. Just a few weeks ago, for instance, a group of DEA agents found out that a plane full of cocaine was flying into an airport in Mexico. They alerted the Mexican Federal Judicial Police, who agreed to send in 25 men, which was good, to go get that airplane. And when the DEA and the MFJP agents arrived at the airport, the plane was being guarded by a whole bunch of Mexican Marines who pulled their guns on the Mexican agents and the DEA agents, and there was a very tense standoff. Finally, the Mexican agents prevailed. They arrested the traffickers, and after about a month, they arrested a few of the Marines, but they didn't immediately arrest the Marines.
I want to get some of your impressions of how the Reagan administration has handled the war on drugs, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Elaine Shannon. She's Washington correspondent for Time magazine. She's reported on the international drug trade for 10 years. Her new book is titled Desperados, Latin Drug Lords, U.S. Lawmen, and the War America Can't Win. She's joining us from the NPR Bureau in New York. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Elaine Shannon is my guest, author of the new book, Desperados, Latin Drug Lords, U.S. Lawmen, and the War America Can't Win. Let's discuss some of your impressions of how the Reagan administration has handled the war against drugs. You write in your new book that for a politician with a law and order image, President Reagan has been strangely disengaged from the drug problem, and I'd like for you to explain what you mean.
Well, during the first 4 or 5 years of the Reagan administration, the Reagan administration cut the budget for drug education and treatment by 40%. In the first 2 years of Reagan's administration, the Office of Management and Budget under him attempted to cut very sharply the law enforcement budgets for DEA and Customs and the FBI. It was so bad in 1981 that a DEA office in Jacksonville, Florida, held a bake sale so they could get money for gasoline to do night stakeouts. That situation was remedied because the Attorney General at that time, Attorney General William French Smith, went to Reagan himself over David Stockman, the budget director's head, and appealed to him and said, look, this is domestic defense, this is really important. So Reagan agreed. But Reagan just really has never seemed very interested in the topic. He didn't get interested in it until 1986 when his pollster came to him and to Don Regan and said, look, people are really upset about drugs in their communities. This could be a big issue in the fall elections, and we need to get on it. The Democrats were also getting on it because their polls were picking up the same thing. So it was very, very, very much motivated by politics.
Well, that pollster's comments that you just mentioned led to the Just Say No campaign. Do you think that's an effective campaign?
Actually, Nancy Reagan had been doing that a little bit before. She had gotten a very bad image when she first came to Washington for wearing a lot of clothes and buying China for the White House. And the White House needed something serious for her to do, so they made this her cause. I think she's done a lot of good. A lot of people from both parties admire her. I mean, she really means what she says, and I think she pays attention, and I think she has been a lot more dedicated and a lot more committed than, let's say, George Bush.
Well, let's get to George Bush. He's responsible for two different anti-drug projects, the South Florida Drug Task Force and the National Border Interdiction System. You say both of these are not taken seriously by federal law enforcement officials.
That's right.
Would you explain a little bit about what these projects are and why you've observed that they're not taken seriously?
Well, the South Florida Task Force was the first. That came in late 82. That had Bush's name on it. Mostly it was the White House's political response to demands from people in Florida who said, we are being overrun. There were cocaine traffickers moving into South Florida. They were shooting at each other on the street. They were a real menace to public safety. A lot of money was floating around, and people were just raising Cain. And so what happened was the White House ordered the agencies, meaning Customs, DEA, FBI, other agencies, to take agents away from other parts of the country and put them in Florida on temporary duty. That's a good idea. They should have put more people there permanently, and they have, as the budgets have gotten larger, put more people there permanently. But this was a political response. I think that the task force did some good, although I think the agencies, with the increased manpower, would have done it anyway. They didn't really need Bush's name. Bush attended a few meetings. He held the press conferences. I've talked to people who briefed him before the press conferences, and they were astonished at his lack of knowledge about the specifics. The second thing that Bush is in charge of is something called the National Narcotics Border Interdiction System. It's just a sort of an office and generates some press releases, but all it does is sort of form a liaison with the Defense Department to get certain kinds of radar and other planes, and that could be done and is being done by the liaison offices at DEA and Customs and the other agencies. So it's really mostly a vehicle for issuing press releases with the Vice President's name on it.
In your new book, Desperados, you write that you're skeptical that George Bush didn't know about Noriega's role in drug trafficking until Noriega's indictment. Why are you so skeptical of that?
How could he not? I knew a lot. Every reporter that covers the beat knew a lot. He's probably correct in saying that we didn't have hard evidence until the grand jury process started going. And what I presume he means is we didn't have people coming in and saying, I directly saw Noriega directly take money. Over the years, starting in gosh, 1970 or 71, when Noriega was head of military intelligence for Panama. He would be the equivalent of the head of the CIA. There were allegations about Noriega protecting traffickers. It was so bad in 1972 that the Nixon White House tried to get General Torrijos, who ran Panama then, to fire Noriega. The White House at that time didn't say much about Noriega in public, but they did in private. The Reagan administration has been much different. DEA and Customs were complaining loudly about the growing money laundering system and the growing transshipment system and the growing transit of high technology to Cuba back in 82, 83. If George Bush didn't know, he certainly had access to intelligence reports and other things that I didn't have access to, and I certainly knew about it.
Oliver North figures into your new book, Desperados. The cocaine cartel was setting up a lab in Nicaragua, and as the DEA was moving in on busting this lab, you say that Oliver North leaked the story so that the bust couldn't be carried through. Would you explain?
That's a real scandal. I think he leaked it. Everybody thinks he did. And the reason is this. The DEA got hold of a trafficker called Barry Seal, and he was a very, very good pilot, and he had a bunch of other pilots working for him, and he performed a service for the Medellin cartel, which is a big Colombian cartel. He flew their dope into the country. He had penetrated to the highest levels of the cartel. Well, DEA had never had an informant this good or this high up. It was like having a mole at the top of the Kremlin. Seal flew into Nicaragua and flew some cocaine out, and he had a hidden camera on his airplane, and it took pictures of him landing at a military airstrip in Nicaragua. Well, the pictures were obtained by the White House, I believe, through the CIA, which put the camera on the plane, and the White House gave those pictures out, and suddenly a story appeared in the Washington Times, not only describing the operation that Seal was involved in, but embroidering on it and adding details and saying that Daniel Ortega, the president of Nicaragua, that his brother Humberto Ortega was involved, and other things that Seal didn't know and did not testify to ever and didn't say and didn't see.
So what's the Oliver North connection, as you understand?
Well, after the pictures were made, DEA wanted to continue the penetration.
In secret?
In secret, yes. And Seal talked of inveigling the heads of the cartel onto his airplane, and instead of flying them to Aruba or Nassau, wherever they wanted to go, he would fly them to Miami. The lab was being built, but it hadn't been completed yet, and DEA wanted to find out where it was, and they wanted to know more about corruption. They said, why not find out exactly what's going on? We need more information. But suddenly this story appeared. It was just very lucky that Seal was not in South America at the time the story appeared, because he would have been killed. He was killed a year later. North knew. He was in meetings. He was briefed on this operation. And when the story appeared, the DEA agent who told North about the operation called him up and cursed him and screamed at him in Brooklynese, and North said, well, I thought it was okay to release it. Well, of course it wasn't. The man's life was in danger. Not only that, North suggested to the agent at one point that Seal take $1.5 million that belonged to the cartel, which Seal was supposed to deliver, and deliver it to the Contras instead.
What do you think was Oliver North's motivation for leaking the story?
To smear the Sandinistas. It was right before a vote on aid to the Contras, and both houses were very angry at the administration. The Senate had just discovered that the administration and CIA had mined the harbors in Nicaragua, and the vote went against the administration. That was when the first major Boland Amendment was passed, preventing armed aid to the Contras. North wanted to turn it around, and he wanted to hurt the Sandinistas.
So he thought that by breaking the story that there might be a Sandinista connection to the drug trafficking, that it would help him in raising money for the Contras.
Absolutely. And it got worse. Ronald Reagan went on television a few months later and used these pictures that Seal took and said the top level of the Nicaraguan government is involved in drug trafficking. And, of course, there was no proof of this.
There was no proof of the Sandinistas' involvement in this?
No, I'm sure that the Sandinistas or some members of the government were corrupted. Seal did land in Nicaragua. He landed in a military field. You can see in the pictures people in uniform unloading a lot of cocaine. But that doesn't mean that the top level of the government was taking the money any more than if you land in Texas and some local policemen come and take cocaine off a plane, which happens, or in Florida or Georgia, that the governor of the state is corrupt. It doesn't follow. You have to have more evidence than they had to say that, and they said it anyway.
Well, I think a conclusion, one of the conclusions that you reach in your new book is that the Reagan administration has been much tougher on drug trafficking when it reflects badly on the communists.
Well, that's the irony, is that at the same time this lab was being built in Nicaragua, the traffickers weren't really staying in Nicaragua. It wasn't their kind of place. They like more luxury than you can get in Managua. So they were staying in Panama. You didn't see Ronald Reagan going on the air and showing pictures of the hotel they were staying at in Panama. There was no proof at the time that General Noriega knew about their stay in Panama, but fairly recently, Noriega's advisor, Jose Blandon, came to the United States. He more or less defected, and he said that Noriega was shaking the traffickers down to the tune of $1 million a month for them to stay in Panama.
We only have about a minute left, but let me ask you this question. Your book has a very pessimistic subtitle, Latin Drug Lords, U.S. Lawmen, and the War America Can't Win. I mean, do you believe that America cannot win the war against drugs?
We can win it if we stop using drugs, or if we slow down and if we notice one another using drugs and do something about it, if we notice our coworkers using drugs and say, look, you know, you've got to cut that out. If we have some responsibility, some punishment for users, whether it's sort of programs where they have to work on weekends or whatever. These foreign countries are not going to win it for us. We don't have enough bullets to shoot at all the traffickers. We don't have enough electric chairs to electrocute them all. We can't expect other countries to do this for us, and that's been our policy for too long. We have to do this ourselves, and I don't know whether we have the will to do that, but we better find it.
Elaine Shannon, thank you very much for talking with us. Elaine Shannon is Washington correspondent for Time magazine. Her new book, Desperados, Latin Drug Lords, U.S. Lawmen, and the War America Can't Win, is published by Viking. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.